Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Now the Obama administration is talking criminal malfeasance in that oil catastrophe that's creeping across the Gulf. Attorney General Eric Holder heads to the region tomorrow to meet with federal prosecutors and state attorneys general. And he says his Justice Department is looking into any possible criminal wrongdoing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ristall. Here's hoping you're enjoying a much-deserved holiday respite as we pay tribute on this Memorial Day 2010. Sorry to say, there's been no break at all from that relentless gusher in the Gulf. Over the weekend, the last best hope to cap BP's runaway well was declared a failure. And now the oil giant has moved on to try another idea to funnel the sludge to the surface. But that approach won't do any more than contain the mess. And it's now looking like the flow won't actually be stopped until August, at the earliest, when two relief wells are supposed to be finished. That dire news has people who make their living from the Gulf rethinking their plans for surviving the spill. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Susan Groh is a Louisiana fishing guide. On a good day, she can make $1,000, but now...
Our business, our fishing business, is completely zero.
Groh says all of her tours this summer have been canceled.
I still have a couple of trips on the books for October. The guys are just hanging on.
Groh is hanging on, too, living off of her savings. And just in case those guys booked for October cancel, she's looking for a job, waitressing maybe. Buggy Vegas is also scraping together a plan B. He owns Bridgeside Marina in Grand Isle, Louisiana. Normally on Memorial Day, the beach would be clogged with sunbathers, but the only people around now are workers cleaning up the oil. Vegas is thinking about turning his marina into a hardware store. When the oil workers come to the marina's restaurant, Vegas asks them, "What supplies do you need?"
I said, "Man, I could do whatever y'all need, a way to get it in here. Lose a pair of gloves or a hat or whatever. Shackles, whatever it takes."
Whatever it takes is also John Williams' mantra. Williams heads the Southern Shrimp Alliance. He's meeting with Washington lobbyists and lawyers tomorrow to put together his contingency plan.
We're going to hash over every issue that's facing the shrimp industry with respect to the oil spill and try to come up with something that we can help, certainly help our members and the industry also.
That could include suing BP, something Williams had ruled out until now. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
185 nations are represented in Bonn, Germany, at the biggest talks on climate change since last December's ill-fated United Nations summit in Copenhagen. For the next 12 days, negotiators will try to set the groundwork for yet another meeting later this year in Mexico, where they hope to reach a binding pact to fight global warming. Kyle James reports from Berlin.
The delegates gathering today in Germany aren't really expecting great things, says Wendell Trio of the environmental group Greenpeace.
The mood is still very cautious. I think a lot of countries are still recovering from what happened in Copenhagen.
There, the high-profile global summit meant to save the planet ended in bickering and without a legally binding accord. This time, delegates are working on smaller climate initiatives instead of trying for a big, overarching deal all in one go. Even then, it won't be easy, says Carlos Busquets of the Environment Division of the International Chamber of Commerce. There's a big rift in Bonn between the rich developed nations and the poorer developing ones.
How do you make that balance for these economies that need to grow to lift their populations out of poverty, with at the same time the acute need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions?
In Copenhagen, developed nations pledged $30 billion over 3 years to help poorer nations reduce emissions and adapt to a changing climate. Greenpeace's Wendell Trio says the developing world is skeptical rich countries will follow through.
Developing countries are saying, if you want us to take action, who is going to pay the bill? What is happening with the money and where is the money and will it come or not?
On day one of the meeting, delegates couldn't agree on the wording of the text that would serve as the basis for going forward. Given all the hurdles, most experts are skeptical that a binding climate pact can be worked out in Cancun, Mexico in December. In Berlin, I'm Kyle James for Marketplace.
Maybe you're stuck in holiday traffic, and maybe you don't need me to tell you this, but AAA has estimated a 6% increase in car travel over last Memorial Day. Now, presumably, a lot of those are rentals. But given how many folks have had their credit cards canceled in recent years, we wondered how tough it might be to rent a car for the holiday without plastic. Marketplace's Gregory Warner found a place that caters to just those customers.
Thank you for calling Just for Wheels. This is Leslie. May I help you?
When Leslie Weller answers the phone at this family-owned car rental agency in Berlin, New Jersey, she always gives people another option if they don't have a credit card.
If you'd like to rent with debit card or cash, you just need to bring your most recent pay stub and your most recent utility bill with you.
Leslie's the manager here at Just for Wheels.
Yes.
She says if you want to rent a car with cash, you just have to put down a deposit of $250.
A lot of people don't qualify for a major credit card, or maybe they don't believe in credit cards. For whatever reason, we're able to get a wider range of people to be able to rent with us.
And give Just for Wheels a small advantage over national chains like Enterprise and Hertz. The strategy might be working. Leslie says her voice is hoarse from dealing with all these Memorial Weekend travelers. The tiny office can get jammed, though it's pretty quiet now. On her desk, she has a snow globe. She uses it to distract children while she rents to their parents.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
You returning?
Just for Wheels grew out of a used car dealership in Atlantic City and now has 8 other locations besides this one in South Jersey. Overall, the company reports that business is up from the past 3 years, though vacations are still short, and more families are doing what Leslie calls clustering.
Like maybe two families get together and rent 2 or 3 15-passenger vans to get the whole group together.
Those passenger vans also appeal to sports teams. Today, Leslie sent 2 vanfuls of roller hockey players to Florida, a swim team to Virginia, and a baseball team to Michigan. And there's still hours to go before the end of her shift.
You're all set.
Thank you very much.
Have a wonderful holiday with your family.
Yep.
Thanks again.
In Berlin, New Jersey, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
There were some financial markets open today. We'll check out how they did when we do the numbers. We've heard such a drumbeat about how too much debt helped derail the economy that it almost begs the question, is there anything good to say about being in hock? Well, there was a time when borrowed money helped millions of GIs open the door to the middle class and own a home. Stephen Smith of American Radio Works reminded us of that in this report.
Our story begins in 1945.
We have another bulletin here. Japan surrenders. Japan surrenders. Now repeating the entire bulletin.
When World War II ended, millions of American servicemen and women returned home. But home was hard to find. After a long war, GIs came back to an acute housing shortage.
We've had a time with housing while you were gone. Building materials and labor went to war.
This government film explained the housing shortage to returning veterans, many of whom had to share crowded quarters with friends and parents and in-laws.
Dottie's folks are swell, but a fellow would like to spend a little time alone with his wife after 3.5 years of community living in barracks and foxholes.
To help the returning vets, President Franklin D. Roosevelt created the GI Bill of Rights. The GI Bill offered a sweeping program of benefits, including government-backed home loans. At the time, most Americans were renters, especially people in their 20s, like veterans.
Owning their own home at that time in their life when they were just getting started in their careers was unheard of.
Author Ed Humes wrote a book about how the GI Bill transformed America. He says that before the government got involved, home loans were something only the better off could afford.
before the war, a typical mortgage was 50% down and a relatively short repayment period. But the financial guarantees and funding of the GI Bill made it possible to offer these then very novel working class mortgages. 30-year mortgages became the standard because of the GI Bill.
If you think about it, Roosevelt may have been the most influential mortgage broker of the 20th century. FDR made it possible for millions of Americans to buy a home and to start building up equity. The GI Bill introduced a whole generation to the potential benefits of long-term debt. When Jerry Ulrich returned to Minnesota from the U.S. Navy, he and his wife Gertrude first tried to get a home loan from their local bank.
They told us right straight out, no way.
Gertrude Ulrich says her husband was the son of a fireman, and the couple had little money. They wanted to buy a house in the budding Minneapolis suburb of Richfield.
The credit and loan said, much as we'd like to see you establish yourself in Richfield and move to Richfield and start a family and all those kinds of things, no, we can't because you don't have any credit rating. We have nothing to go by. So that's why they suggested the GI Bill.
In fact, the federal government not only backed the Ulrich's mortgage, the GI Bill paid for Jerry's dental school. It also provided a low-interest business loan so Jerry could set up a practice. With millions of young World War II vets eligible for mortgages in the 1940s and 50s, there was an explosion of home building. Author Ed Humes.
The GI Bill led to the creation of modern American suburbia.
Suburbia meant shopping malls, interstate highways, and the baby boom. With more credit available, Americans bought more consumer goods like cars, refrigerators, and televisions. The post-war years marked the high point of American prosperity. Today, as the so-called greatest generation passes on, historian Lendell Calder says it will hand down a vast amount of middle-class wealth.
Late baby boomers like myself stand to inherit more than any previous generation in American history.
Even with the current recession, economists say that figure is some $40 trillion or more. Lendell Calder says we have debt to thank, at least in part. Sure, Calder says, credit cards and home equity loans made it easy for some people to live beyond their means, but debt also encouraged something else.
You sign your name on a piece of paper, which gives you delivery on something you really, really wanted, but then follows weeks and months and sometimes years of hard work to pay back on those bills. That's not hedonism, or at least it doesn't look like hedonism to me. That looks like a form of economic discipline.
Back in Richfield, Minnesota, Gertrude Ulrich and her husband paid their bills on schedule, raised six children, and sent them all to college. She says it's all because the government made it possible for a young sailor and his wife to borrow some money and to work their way into the middle class. This is Stephen Smith for Marketplace.
Think of our last story as prologue as we turn to the post-9/11 version of the GI Bill. It's on the books, but the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee is considering changes. Just last week, Committee Chairman Daniel Akaka of Hawaii proposed making some improvements. Veteran Tim Embry is Legislative Associate for the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
The post-9/11 GI Bill went into effect in August of last year, but veterans groups like yours are still pushing for other changes. What do you think is needed?
Well, Bob, if you look at the history of the GI Bill, it's a phenomenal benefit. And just like the post-9/11 GI Bill, it's an amazing benefit that is really helping a lot of folks as they're coming out of the military. And so what we've been pointing out is with the new post-9/11 GI Bill, though it is amazing and it's doing great things, there's just a couple things that need to be tweaked. It's kind of like when that first iPhone came out. You know, it was great when it first came out. Now they just had to make a couple tweaks, and now it's phenomenal. So it's the same type of thing.
Well, one of the issues that I've heard discussed is online courses or distance learning isn't covered under the current law. Why is that important?
Well, what it is we have a lot of folks that maybe come home and are dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder or recovering from a traumatic brain injury or live in a rural area. And they're trying to attend these non-traditional colleges online through correspondence because a lot of times they can't get to the brick-and-mortar schools. So we want to make sure that their tuition is covered and also they have a living stipend. Because we know how tough it is where, You know, if you're taking a class online, and the reason for that is because you maybe are, maybe it is tough for you to get out of the house. We want to be able to make it so these folks can actually pay their rent or pay their mortgage.
What about troops returning from service who don't want to go to a four-year college?
That's a big one. If you actually look at the original GI Bill, over 70% of the folks in the original GI Bill went to vocational school, on-the-job training programs, and apprenticeship programs. And that was one of the things that we're really trying to push to be part of the post 9/11 GI Bill. And in fact, Senator Akaka just the other day dropped the comprehensive upgrade package that we had been working with his office as well as Senator Webb's office and a few other folks on. And this is one of the things that it points out is, you know, making sure that folks can go to vocational schools, can go to on-the-job training, you know, can do that apprenticeship. Because these are the folks that are opening up, you know, your mechanic shops and your repair shops. These are the EMTs and folks like that. So it's a really important thing.
Well, perhaps on this day more than most, setting aside the GI Bill, this is a good day to talk about the problems that exist for troops when they re-enter the workforce. Can you give us a hint on some of those?
It's rough. It's really rough. Last year's average for Iraq and Afghanistan era veterans was 14.7%. Just this past month, it's still at about 13.1% unemployment for OAF and OEF, and that's Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. You know, it's tough for these guys. You got the military that speaks one language, and you have the civilian world that speaks another. So you have folks that, you know, they're coming back and may leave the military, may spend some time hanging out with their friends, maybe spend some time sleeping in their mom's basement. And then they get to a world where, you know, they don't know how to translate their skills.
Tim Embry is Legislative Associate for the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Thank you for joining us. Best to you, sir.
Thank you very much, Bob. Have a good Memorial Day.
Coming up, aid for vets from vets in prison.
That's the whole mantra of never leaving a comrade behind, you know, going back and taking care of our own as veterans.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stock markets here at home took Memorial Day off, but there was trading in other parts of the world. London's FTSE was also closed today, but stocks elsewhere in Europe were mostly flat. In Asia, markets started mixed, then closed higher for the most part, and this will set the stage as trading resumes tomorrow. Some worrisome numbers about the already shaky European financial situation. Banks in the Eurozone are facing a second wave of potential loan losses over the next year and a half that could total up to 195 billion euros, according to the European Central Bank. That figures out to $240 billion. Actually, one bit of good news in that number, it's less than previously estimated. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. Arizonans will see their sales tax increase by 1%. 2 weeks ago, voters overwhelmingly approved the change to avoid big budget cuts. United Nations officials kick off a climate change meeting in Bonn, Germany. And 72 years ago, Superman officially debuted. The two creators were paid $130 for the first comic book, which now sells for more than $5,300. I'm Cormac O'Connor.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Keep your seatbelts fastened when Wall Street starts a new month tomorrow. The Dow has had a bad case of nerves, and the past week's headlines don't exactly inspire confidence, especially this one from Reuters. Regulators may never pinpoint the cause of that May 6th crash. the one that everybody keeps calling a glitch, but nobody can really explain. Nearly a month out, top regulators say we may never know for sure. So what should we, who have money in stocks, make of this? Peter Cohen has some views on that. He's a market analyst and president of Peter Cohen & Associates. Welcome.
Thank you.
So how can the regulators, after all this time, not have any clue as to what happened?
Well, there's four reasons. I'll try to go through them quickly. First, there are different regulators covering different markets, and I think that maybe what happened here was something that overlapped their jurisdictions. Second of all, computerization creates so much data on a daily basis that sorting through it and figuring out what matters and what doesn't is a huge analytical task, and they can't do it ahead of time, so they only do it when they investigate a real big problem that happened afterwards. Third of all, the people who are doing the trading are just smarter and better paid than the people who are regulating them. And finally, the technology of finance is always staying several steps ahead of the regulators, so it's a very, very difficult job.
Peter, in one of your columns, you point to a quote of the Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, on May 17th, saying, "Our financial system is so complicated and so interactive, so many different markets in different countries and so many sets of rules, I just think it's not realistic to think that human beings can fully anticipate all of the possible interactions and complex developments." That's from the Federal Reserve chairman.
That really, really stuck out to me because he is extremely smart. He should know more than anybody else about what's going on in the markets, and he says it's too much for him. So how is the average investor supposed to figure it out?
What is the deal with today's market that makes it so difficult to pinpoint these problems?
Well, one of the things that I think is really important to bear in mind, and it's not repeated often enough, is that 70% of the volume of trading on the stock exchanges these days is done by something called flash traders. And that's basically computers that buy and sell stocks and hold them for about 11 seconds on average. So all the discussion we have about the economy, politics, regulation, company earnings, all that stuff, I mean, there's just no way that a computer holding and selling a stock in 11 seconds is going to be able to do all that analysis. So it's all really out the window. And there's no clear-cut explanation for why stocks move up and down every day. And frankly, the fact that we have media trying to make these reports about how it's related to this or that is just not very helpful for the average investor.
So you're saying Greek debts or the rioting in Greece had nothing to do with this?
You know, if this was really the reason, problems in Greece were known as early as March 25th or March 26th when they passed a first bailout package. So there was a month there where the stock market kept going up, but the Greek problem was out there in the market and it was well known. Everybody knew about it. Why didn't the stock market crash then?
This is all confusing me about the same way that when I pull the handle on a slot machine, I don't know what the payout is. So with all this craziness, how does that differ from just walking into a casino and taking your chances?
When you do that, you know that the house is going to win. When you bet on stocks, you think that there's some chance you might be able to use some intelligent reasoning and make money. But the fact of the matter is that I think the casinos are doing a better job of disclosure of what's really going on than the stock market.
Not to prove a negative here, but if we don't know what happened, how do we not know this was a real crash?
We don't know. We don't know what we don't know. And it's really disconcerting. And the only thing that's good about it is that it doesn't happen every day. And hopefully the measures that they've put in place will keep this from happening again. And they will keep investigating until they figure out what happened. And hopefully they will resolve it.
Peter Cohen is an analyst and president of Peter Cohen & Associates. His latest book is called Capital Rising. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
There was word this past week that Oprah Winfrey is winding down her Angel Network, along with her show's final TV season. She founded the nonprofit in 1998 to raise money from fans for a variety of causes. It's a tough time for charities. Contributions are less of a priority in family and corporate budgets given the recession. Still, one group of unlikely philanthropists hasn't been fazed by the downturn. From Blythe, California, Sonata Lee Narsis has the story.
James White is a former Marine and Vietnam War veteran.
I worked my way up to sergeant, and I was awarded a medal by a general.
For 23 years, White has run a charitable organization. But there's one unique thing about his work.
Your heart is open. Stand by for release.
He does it from behind bars at Ironwood State Prison. White is a founding member of the Veterans Group of Ironwood. About 150 inmates belong to the group, and they've donated more than $250,000 in the last decade. They do it by selling pizzas.
And we sell the pizzas to inmates, make a little bit of profit, and then all our money is turned around and given back into the community.
The veterans have permission to do 3 pizza sales a year. They have a lot of customers, about 4,000 inmates. And it's not every day an inmate gets the chance to order their own Domino's pizza. The veterans group makes about $30,000 a year. About half goes to community groups like Blythe Little League and the local Girl Scouts. The other half goes to the Independence Fund. That fund provides support for injured soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan. David Long is the prison's deputy warden. He's also a former Marine.
That's the whole mantra of never leaving a comrade behind, you know, going back and taking care of our own as veterans.
3 hours west of Blythe in a Pasadena hotel, Army Sergeant Major Jesse Acosta prepares to give a keynote address. He's speaking to a group that received money from the veterans of Ironwood.
Every time I go up and I speak, it's straight from the heart.
Acosta himself was blinded by a mortar attack while fighting in Iraq. Last year, he heard about the Ironwood Veterans Mission and was so moved, he volunteered to serve as the group's outside representative. Back in October, he received a check from the veterans for the Independence Fund.
When the group introduced a check for $10,000, I was like stunned.
A month later, the veterans group of Ironwood presented the Independence Fund with another check for $5,000. The money goes towards high-tech wheelchairs for amputees. Acosta says the inmates' donations make a huge difference in wounded veterans' lives.
It means independence. Yeah, they may not have their legs back, but you know what? They have a wheelchair that can go upstairs, downstairs, can go in the beach, can go up a hill, up a curb.
That kind of freedom is something James White can only dream about at this point in his life. He's serving a life sentence for murder, without the chance of parole. But he sees his charitable work as a small step towards redemption.
Just because a guy's in prison, for whatever he did wrong, doesn't make him what he was the day he was, did whatever crime he did. He may have turned a corner. There's a lot of good guys in here.
In Blythe, California, I'm Sonata Lee Narcisse for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, how many times have you made your way through the telephone maze to a customer service help desk, only to figure out you're talking to somebody on the other side of the world? Now there's a lawmaker who thinks there ought to be a law. Senator Charles Schumer wants to slap a 25-cent tax on every such call and require that customers be tolled whenever their calls are being sent outside the U.S. The New York Democrat says it's aimed at reducing the outsourcing of American jobs. Would it make any difference to you? Let us know at marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. The markets were closed today for the Memorial Day holiday. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, oh, how times have changed from the housing crash of the 90s to today.
You see these big deals and banks getting bailed out, it makes you a little less sympathetic than you otherwise be for a bank to whom you have the obligation. People say, if the big guys can do it, why can't I?
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai back here for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.